Hello, and welcome to An Englishman in the Balkans. I'm David Bailey, and over the past nearly 12 years, this podcast has taken on many forms, from interviews and audio diaries to cultural snapshots and expat reflections. You might notice some different podcast names mentioned along the way, but it's all part of the same journey, one that explores life, people, and stories from this fascinating region I now call home. If you're enjoying the listen, I'd love it if you left a quick review or rating wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps others discover the show. And if something in the episode sparks your interest or curiosity, why not drop me a message? I always enjoy hearing from listeners. I always reply.
You're listening to An Englishman in the Balkans.
Welcome to An Englishman in the Balkans podcast with me, David Pacinovic Bailey. In this podcast, you'll get a unique look at life in Bosnia and Herzegovina through my eyes, the eyes of an immigrant. Each episode, I share my experiences living in this often misunderstood country and introduce you to some of the interesting people I've met along the way. From exploring the rich culture and history to discussing the challenges and joys of immigrating to a new country, this podcast offers a thoughtful and engaging look at life in the Western Balkans.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you would like to support us and the production of future episodes, then please consider maybe giving us a tip or becoming a member of our podcast family. The link to do that is in the show notes for this podcast. Thanks again for listening. We really do appreciate it.
You're listening to An Englishman in the Balkans.
Welcome to An Englishman in the Balkans, the podcast that takes you on a captivating journey into the heart of Bosnia and Herzegovina and the wider Western Balkans. Each episode, we delve into the rich history, vibrant culture, and hidden gems of this beautiful country. Through engaging conversations and personal anecdotes, we aim to bridge the gap between the Balkans and the rest of the world. So sit back, relax, and get ready to be inspired, entertained, and connected.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you would like to support us and the production of future episodes, then please consider maybe giving us a tip or becoming a member of our podcast family. The link to do that is in the show notes for this podcast. Thanks again for listening. We really do appreciate it.
We were, you know, around these buildings doing this stuff, and he said, "Hey guys, hey, stop what you're doing. There's landmines here."
You're listening to the Living in Bosnia and Herzegovina podcast.
Welcome to the Living in Bosnia and Herzegovina podcast, where we talk to interesting people and hear stories from this misunderstood, heart-shaped country in Southeast Europe. In this episode, I talk to David Harms, a Canadian who at the age of 22 was a documentary photographer for the Red Cross in 1993's war-torn Croatia, experiencing the effects of conflict and dodging mines. He came back to the region again 16 years later, only to be thrown out of one of the countries. We'll find out which one. It's quite the story, so let's crack on and find out who David Harms is.
Thanks, that's a great way to do an introduction. That's good. I could maybe start by saying, in addition to sharing a first name, we both have miserable winter weather going on. You know, the first day of March here, and it's rainy and not quite snowy, but right around the freezing mark. And so it's really not the day we want to kick our spring off with, but we're getting there. So I don't know. Talking about me, it's always a long story, I feel. But generally speaking, I work in the communication media nexus, from photography to media analysis up to now teaching in strategic communication. And so it's been a fun journey. I had a professor once who, when we asked him why you go into this field of communications, he says, "That's an interesting way to pass the time between birth and death." So yeah, that led me to it. I said, well, you got to pick something, and that's fun. But it's really like just being in media of any sort and photography specifically, one of the great advantages is that you have to go places. And you get to travel to a lot of really different and unique and interesting places. And these are some of the reasons that I've been able to travel to the Balkans a couple of times now. So, you know, is that it in a nutshell? There's always more, but we can tease that out as we chat.
Yeah, we're going to talk about your trips here. You're in Kitchener. Now, listen, I know that Kitchener is in Ontario, and you have a media project, and I'll put the link to it at the bottom for people that are interested. And it's a hyper-local community radio platform. But I've always wondered why... And maybe you can explain this to me. Why Kitchener-Waterloo? I always thought they were two places, or are they one and one is like a subdivision of the other?
This is one of the greatest debates in Southern Ontario. And so the city of Kitchener and the city of Waterloo are two distinct municipalities that touch each other. And they're both in the region of Waterloo. And so we often see it written as Kitchener-Waterloo, like hyphenated, because the two cities are, you know, they're really divided by a hilltop, which I live on. And but they're in the region of Waterloo. And so often internationally, they talk a lot about Waterloo as a region because of the University of Waterloo. It's internationally renowned for its computer sciences. And of course, the birth of the smartphone, right? The BlackBerry was developed here in Waterloo, by a company called Research in Motion, then turned to BlackBerry, now back to Research in Motion, or RIM, maybe they call it. But nonetheless, you know, the smaller of the municipalities seems to have a greater international reputation. So it's a little bit confusing. We have you know, there's always debates going on whether we should amalgamate the cities, because they're basically just like two different neighborhoods, right? And I'd have to explain that it's the geography here is quite, you know, despite everything being large in Canada, the geography in this region feels quite small, where I can get to downtown Kitchener walking 10 minutes in one direction, and downtown Waterloo by walking 10 minutes in the other direction. But they've also interestingly branded the downtown of Waterloo as Uptown, to be in opposition to Kitchener. So there's a good rivalry that goes on. There's downtown Kitchener, there's Uptown Waterloo, and this wonderful area in between that we live in called Midtown. At least that's what we're calling it, and developing things around that.
I always like that. Well, it should be fun, community infighting, but sometimes it doesn't. I come from London, so there's always infighting between whether you're a northerner, a southerner, an east ender or a west ender, and I'm a west ender. We first met in the mid noughties, I think around about 2005 time, when I arrived in Ontario to work on a military project, and you were there, and I was trying to explain to people that didn't know much about the Balkans, about the complexities of the area. And I remember you saying, well, I've been there before. And I went, what? And I thought, you were a soldier there? And you said, no, I was a photographer, which, you know, took the wind right out of my sails at the time. You were there, I believe, in Croatia back in 1993. Now, when I first came to Bosnia-Herzegovina, that was in 1993 in the area of a place called Tomislavgrad. And it wasn't, it was anything but pleasant. I'd never seen such a level of violence that human beings could do to each other. And it was quite traumatic, at the same time exciting, at the same time terrifying. In 1993, you were on the other side of the Dinaric Alps in Croatia. So why did you end up there as a young photographer?
It's a really like a transformative time in my life too, because I was studying photography at Ryerson University in Toronto, and really interested in photojournalism. And one of my colleagues was an international student from Germany, and we were together interested in, you know, all the things that were going on in Europe in the early 90s. And then the opportunity came up through people he knew to be able to travel to parts of Croatia with the Red Cross, and to be able to what was the task at the time was to document the effects of warfare on civilian populations. And so we thought, you know, documentary work, this is exactly the kind of stuff that we wanted to do. And all we had to do was get ourselves there. And so essentially we went like a summer vacation kind of thing from school in the off semester, went to Germany. And this is my first time in Europe at all. And then we drove, and he had like a little Renault, and we drove from Karlsruhe in the far western edge of Germany, you know, all the way down, sleeping in his car at different times, and we made our way worked our way down to Zagreb, where we had sort of met our first contact. And it was interesting, you know, just like being in Europe for the first time and then traveling, you know, working your way towards a conflict zone. It was nerve wracking. And I'll never forget one night we were in Zagreb, and we got some food somewhere and then find a quiet place to park the car so we could sleep for the night and carry on in the morning. And, you know, we were woken up in the middle of the night by this, you know, this tapping sound of, you know, it's very specific now, but it's the tapping sound of a rifle, you know, against the window of the car. And these soldiers just wanted to know what we were doing there. When you don't know anything about this stuff, that's very, very scary and very nerve wracking. And this experience, you know, and I'll tell you more about it, but this experience is what led me to joining the military, to be able to learn more about it. And as a way of staying safe as a photographer, as a photojournalist.
Zagreb then and Zagreb now are two completely different cities. Yes, they are the same, but the whole ambience, everything about it is different. I found when I came to this area that, you know, having a different language, a different culture, and, you know, I just felt like you're in a swimming pool and you haven't got a clue about how to swim, and you think that everybody around you will be there to save you, and actually you feel so desperately alone. After that night, did that put you off? Did you think about going back, or was it a case of the adrenaline saying, no, we have to go and get on with this assignment? Because what I think that you might have been exposed to afterwards, you'll tell us, was going to be far from anything of conflict Zagreb.
That's it. Zagreb was far from it. And it's just kind of nerve-wracking, because of all of a sudden the, you know, the presence of military people all over the place. But we sort of felt at the time, like, as soon as we can get to where we're going, which was Osijek in the kind of the far east of Croatia, as soon as we can get there and meet up with our local guide, then all of this will be okay, because we had a place to stay then. We were going to be with somebody, a representative from the Red Cross, who would be able to kind of take us around and, you know, keep us safe, essentially. And so it was just the getting there was the scariest part. Once we got there, like, that's, you know, that it's a whole nother world then, because then you are starting to see the actual impacts of the war. And it's horrifying. It's scary, and it's horrifying what was happening at the time. But this was our job. And so we thought, you know, if this is the kind of thing that we want to do, you know, as a career, you'd have to kind of, you know, swallow your nerves a little bit and get on with it.
You know, when you were there, when you arrived there and you got out to do the first jobs that the Red Cross wanted you to do, and you were saying, you know, about being exposed to things that were well and truly outside the norms, did you ever think about, you know, you being there, but your fellow students who were on vacation were either in the Caribbean or somewhere else having a fine time, but on the other hand, they weren't getting the experience that you were getting?
Yeah, I think so, because most people are certainly doing that sort of thing for their summer. They're, you know, they're going somewhere fun. They're working at a resort or something, earning a little bit of money. And we were always of the mind that, you know, this is the important work. And this is like, there's always time to have a vacation, and that's fine. But there's serious things going on in the world. And as aspiring journalists, we were thinking that this was, you know, this is a very important story to be told. Much of the coverage, as you know, much of the coverage of conflict is really about, you know, the fighting and the destruction, and not quite as much about what the impacts are like on the civilian populations that are living in all these areas at the time. And I'll remember, like, you know, aspects when we're driving around this region. You know, there was people that were showing us, there's like, you know, a rocket or a missile or something came in through the roof of their house, like through the bedroom, out the window, and blew up in between the two houses. And so the people survived, but, you know, obviously, you know, a very traumatic experience. And then into the countryside, where there was, you know, there was very intense fighting, and it became sad, you know, I mean, because you're going around talking to people who are living through this. And, you know, they're people, I would say, are like our parents' age, that are showing us photographs of their children that are our age. They're like, you know, our kids are off now fighting the war, essentially. And in some cases, they don't know if they're alive or not. In other cases, they do know, and they're not alive. And it's very sad, of course, like all conflict is. But it was really, like, as I say, for a 22-year-old to be doing this, it was such an eye-opening experience in terms of the realities of some of the things that are going on in different parts of the world. And we thought, you know, if our colleagues from school are having a fun beach vacation, that's, you know, it's like living with your head in the sand, you know, where you're not, all of this information is out there, you're just not paying attention to it.
Whether you're a television journalist, a radio journalist, or a documentary photographer like you guys were, all three of those skills are basically wrapped up in one, which is you're a storyteller, and you've got to go and tell a story to a particular audience. When you're seeing things that are so emotional like that, especially back in the 90s here, in this very violent cauldron of hate and whatever that was going on, whether it be Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, or wherever, you know, and you're young as well, how did you sort of like get the wherewithal to look at all this and say, what's the story here? Was it a difficult thing to do, or did you find that it just sort of like rolled off the shoulders? Yeah, I know what I want to do here. I mean, because to stand back and take 5 or 10 minutes to say, what is the story and how am I going to compose shots and everything with all this mayhem going on around you must be exceedingly difficult, I would have thought.
Yes, exceedingly difficult, I think, is a good way to explain it. And we, at 22 years old, we had the luxury of ignorance, I would say, that we didn't know what the story was or what it was going to be. And so the point was just document, and we'll figure that out afterwards. That's why I say, like, the, you know, we spent every day, you know, around and photographing in different locations. And it was not until we were sort of back working with our professors, going through all the contact sheets and looking at all the different imagery, where we were trying to sort of make sense of it all and pull through, you know, a narrative structure of some sort that's going to help to tell the story. But it was that, you know, we were really relying on people who were a generation older than us, who knew a little bit more of the history and knew a little bit more of, you know, the bigger strategic picture that was going on in the conflict to help us be able to discern that.
What was the biggest takeaway from that period of time in Croatia for you?
That it was dangerous. That it was you know, being a photojournalist, it sounds fun and sexy and glamorous, and you're going to interesting places, but it is dangerous. And there was, you know, I remember one situation where we were, you know, we were around some broken down buildings, like they were all sort of, exploded. The top half of the buildings were missing. And our guide from the Red Cross was, you know, was meeting with the landowner. And so they're sort of on the street talking, and we were moving around taking photographs in different areas. And, you know, like kids getting away from you when you're having a conversation, we were, you know, around these buildings doing this stuff. And he said, "Hey guys, hey, stop what you're doing. There's landmines here." And as soon as somebody says landmines and you're walking in the tall grass around buildings, like the terror that comes over you, just like frozen, you know, not being able to move, not being able to take another step. And it's like, what do you mean? And so he smartly directed us. You know, we basically climbed back up onto the walls of this building and worked our way back, you know, towards the street and towards safety. But it was really like that alone was the, you know, I think I often think about it as like, that was the catalyst that led me to joining the military, that specifically. Yeah. There was another colleague from our school at the time. He was in a different year, so we didn't know him personally. But he had also gone that summer, and we were in Croatia. He was in Bosnia, and he was killed. And he was killed in the conflict, you know, as a student, as a photographer. And so it was just like, you know, you're thinking, what a tragic loss. And of course, you know, this is one person, but it's, you know, for the people we're meeting with, or they're just, you know, the loss is immeasurable. So many aspects of that, as I say, from the specific things around safety and learning about what militaries do as a way to stay safer, to just gaining an empathy for others that I previously didn't have.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you would like to support us and the production of future episodes, then please consider maybe buying us a coffee. The link to do that is in the show notes for this podcast.
We'll talk about your second visit to the area in just a minute, but I want to fire this one at you because you're a professor now in an educational institution which deals with the media, and you're advising and you're mentoring a whole new generation of young people that, you know, will be you in, I don't know, 20 years time or whatever it is. When you see the current drench of misinformation, disinformation, and a little bit of truth as stories on the media that we have access to today, and having had that experience all those years, and that must have been an amazingly impactful experience that you had, when you take what you've actually experienced and you see what is going on now, how easy or how difficult maybe is it when you get asked questions by your students about, hey, David, what about this? What about this? Look, I've seen this. You know, we're gonna be creating content or telling stories in the future. How would you advise we go about it? What's the feeling inside when you get asked those questions now?
I'm always amazed at how basically how smart students are today, and certainly it's a consequence of growing up in the media environment, right? Growing up as digital natives. And so when I compare it back to that time period, it's like we were living in simpler times, right? There was no social media. There was just the early parts of the World Wide Web were getting out. As I said, we were shooting film at the time, and when I look back at the timeline of this, like I would have gotten my first email address the year following this trip. And so, this was still very much an analog world. You have to wait for the newspapers to come out and so on and so forth. And now students really seem to, having grown up in this environment where there's just so many competing perspectives and competing opinions, they seem to do a pretty good job of wading their way through all of that to be able to find and rely on trusted sources. And so, yes, there's a lot of noise, and yes, there's a lot of competing opinions and whatnot, but they tend to be able to identify some of the key sources that they have come to trust and use that or rely on that for the credible information they need.
We worked together for, I don't know, 2.5 years. Won't go into that at all because we keep the audience sort of like, ooh, what's going on back there, so they can make their own minds up. But we were, in essence, in the storytelling business. I certainly learned a lot more about storytelling than I'd ever thought I'd known before, and I'm sure you did too. And then we bumped into each other again. I'd left Canada, was back in Southeast Europe, in Kosovo, actually, and you were doing your PhD, and you came here to look at different media as part of the thesis that you were putting together. I don't think it's classified anymore, even if it ever was at the time. But what fascinated you about coming back to this particular region to research something for your future career?
I was studying international broadcasting and looking specifically at how international broadcasting is being used in different state building or nation building contexts. And of course, Afghanistan was the mission that was at the forefront for most people at that time period. But I thought the interesting part of the study is always to see, not what's happening in the here and now, but what's happening, a decade or more after the fact. And so how do we start to look at the long-term impacts of some of these projects? And so studying radio in Afghanistan really gave the here and now perspective, but I thought it would be an interesting approach to be able to look at the impacts of some of these stations that were in Southwestern Europe and be able to sort of compare what the impacts would look like. And so to say, did this have any sort of enduring change or impact on the community at the time? Like, obviously it does at the time, but does something stick around after the fact? And so it was you know, it was a good opportunity to be able to go and look at some of the ones that were happening in Kosovo, in Bosnia, and then up into back up into Croatia.
I mean, you were doing your research, but how did you find the region had changed since you were there before? Okay, accepted it was peaceful, but did it give you a view of what you thought it might look like the years before when you were actually the documentary photographer? Because at some time you must have thought, what's this place going to look like when all this settles down? And then you go back when it has settled down. Did it join up, or were you surprised, shocked, or disappointed?
All of the above. Yeah, surprised, shocked, and disappointed all at once. Part of the direction, the itinerary of the trip was going to take me back to Osijek. And that was one of the points of being there, is to be able to go back, you know, all those years later to see a town that really, you know, it really, I say, took a pounding during the war. And I was very curious to see what would it be like afterwards. And so, if you remember, I came to see you first in Kosovo, and as a way of, you know, acclimatizing to the region a little bit before getting on my way.
Yeah, what you actually mean to say is getting used to rakia.
Getting used to rakia, yeah, of course. getting my tolerance up again. Yeah, honestly, like, because, you know, we had the joke about it from the first trip, where, you know, you're meeting people at 10 o'clock in the morning, and you might be having a drink with people, and we'd say, you know, my friend asked our fixer what the drinking and driving rules were like, and he laughed and he sort of looks around, you know, and there's just all these bombed out buildings and stuff. He's like, we have bigger problems than that. And so I knew a little bit about the culture and what to expect, but yes, there is a certain amount of acclimatizing required again. And so, you know, we had all the successes in Kosovo that we needed to have relative to the research and to conducting interviews and so forth. And it was when I was trying to get on my way to go north where that changed again a little bit. And I'm not sure if you remember at the time, David, but we sort of, after, you know, a final night with you guys, packed my bags and got on a bus in the morning. And the intent was to go north up to Belgrade and then to Novi Sad. And this was in July. And so I had this brilliant plan of being able to go to the Exit Music Festival. And then, you know, just from there, go back across the river and over to Osijek. And I thought, you know, this will be a great way to experience some new things, see some new places, and then also return back to some places that I'd been before. And that, of course, you know, the best laid plans were scuttled by, some passport problems, we might say. Do you remember this?
Yeah, I remember, yeah. Because you tried to cross from Kosovo into Serbia, and Serbia found that quite insulting. And I do believe that they made you walk back across no man's land with your heavy bag.
That's right. And it was really, this was, right when you think you have all the best plans and everything. And as I say, it was, you know, on this bus going north, and at the border area, getting out of Kosovo into Serbia proper. Yeah, when the bus pulled over and they were checking everybody's passports, they looked at mine and said some things. And it was really, like, it was a little bit nerve-wracking because the bus really went quiet. Like, everybody on the bus went quiet. Everybody just looking straightforward. And these, you know, these border guards were, you know, starting to raise their voice. And of course, I didn't know what they were saying, but I could, obviously, it was directed at me. And then somebody nearby who spoke English said, they say you have to get off the bus. And, you know, of course, I protested and you know, asked why. And they explained, you know, because you're in the country illegally, is all they said. Not being one to argue with armed border guards, I got off the bus and grabbed my backpack and watched the bus drive away. And it was a bizarre experience being all alone, sort of in the countryside with my backpack. And I looked and I had, you know, my water bottle, and I had, like, you know, 2 inches of water left in my water bottle. The sun is beating down. It's July. And I was, you know, a little bit dehydrated from the night before. And so I just started thinking, like, well, what am I going to do now? I walked back a little bit because I remember I had seen there was a NATO checkpoint, but it was a trying to remember the name. There was a force of the, essentially a NATO force, but it had a different name. K4 maybe?
K4.
And so there was a K4 checkpoint there. And so I thought I could go in, and certainly there's going to be people who speak English there and they can provide me with some advice. I did that and went back, and there was a German officer there who was like, oh, and he explained the whole thing to me. He's like, yeah, well, you flew into a place that they don't recognize. And so you have a Kosovo stamp in your passport, but no entry stamp into Serbia. And so they would have said, you're in the country illegally and you cannot proceed. And that's why they kicked me out. You know, it was a little bit sad that I didn't get to go to the music festival. I didn't get to go back around to Osijek, but it did put me on a whole new adventure to kind of get up back up that way north through the countryside. And just a brilliant trip following that. Planes, trains, and automobiles, you know, in and out of from Kosovo to Montenegro and so on and so forth, all the way back up to Zagreb.
You know, when you, with the experiences that you've had, you've been able to harness those, and it's supported you now to be somebody that is, as I said before, responsible for bringing on a whole new generation of young media professionals. You know, when you go back to that start when you were going through your educational process, when you were at Ryerson with your professors, how does it make you feel now that you're that professor? That's the first part of this question. The second part of this question is, what is your view of these new young people? Because it doesn't matter whether you've been in the military or you've been a coal miner or you've been an office worker. People historically say, oh, they were different in my day. How do you feel things have impacted you as a professor? And two, what do you think of this new generation coming along that you're going to be responsible for?
Yeah, I feel a lot of responsibility to them for sure, mostly because I benefited greatly from, the wisdom of professors that I had while I was coming through, and being able to not just taking classes with them, but being able to assist on research projects and travel together to go to conferences and these sort of things. And so there was almost like a mentorship as much as just the regular parts of the education. And so, yeah, I feel like, I benefited tremendously from that experience while I was a student. And now, you know, on the flip side of that coin, where I'm a professor, I really look to how I can sort of, you know, return the favor and help students today with that, just that kind of little extra, like something that's just over and above what they're doing in the classes already, helping to have people, you know, achieve meaningful things in their education process. Now, of course, it's been tough over the last couple of years because of the pandemic, but certainly we're getting back to that type of situation now where we can be out of the classroom and experiencing everything from field trips to learning experiences that way to going on other ways to get to conferences and these sorts of things.
You just mentioned the pandemic there, and now that we can, I hope, sort of like get traveling again, what would you be happy to see your students come up with? I mean, back in the day, it was, hey, me and my friend, we're going to go off to Croatia and do some documentary photography in a conflict zone, which must have said to your professors at the time, what? That's wild and wacky and very unusual. Good for you. What would you consider to be an exciting thing when your students come up to you and say, hey, prof, this is what we're going to be doing during our semester? What would surprise you?
When they get out into the community to work with, you know, real life people and real life organizations, that's always motivating. And because I teach an international public relations course, where they start to explore things around the world and seeing how many places that people have an interest in traveling to, because again, they're young and they haven't really had opportunities to do much yet. And so when I see their interest and their connection for whatever reason to different parts of the world, it gives me great hope. And I recommend that they travel at any opportunity that they have, because, you know, obviously life gets a little bit more complicated as you get older, and your ability to just, you know, pick up and go for 3 months or something like this is harder to do. And so that's something I try to encourage people to do at that stage in their life. And also, you know, through that experience, so where we were able to volunteer our time with the Red Cross, as a way of facilitating that entire trip. And so it's something that I do recommend with a lot of people to, in the areas they want to go and the issues that they want to study and be involved with, is to look at a lot of the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations that are there, and see if they can volunteer their time or get a job or whatever the case is. But some way where they're going to work with an organization that's going to take them to another part of the world. Because there is a very big difference between the experiences that you have when you go somewhere as a tourist compared to the experiences you get when you go somewhere to work. Because you often go to a lot more smaller cities or secondary sort of places that you wouldn't normally go. They're certainly off the tourist trail, as well as just the types of people that you meet, like the things like boredom, things like waiting and having to use city buses and stuff like this. And a lot of people, you go to a beach and you're not experiencing those kinds of things. But when you're having to take public transit to work in the morning in some remote area, that you really, you really start to understand what the local culture is like, what people's routines are, from grabbing breakfast on the go to where you're getting your coffees and these sorts of things. And to me, that's, that is always the most enriching part of traveling, is to be able to experience the culture in a way that is authentic.
They say, especially when you get to my age, and I'm older than you, I'm not going to tell you how much, but they always say you never stop learning in life. And I sign up to that. So finally, David, because I've had you now for almost 40 minutes, what is next for David Harms and his involvement with media?
Well, as you mentioned, we've been focusing a lot on the radio station here in Kitchener-Waterloo. And this has been we started it before the pandemic, but it's been a great pandemic project because everyone, is stuck at home, and we were already set up reasonably well to do this digitally. But for me now, I feel like the next big stage is getting back out into the world and being able to do more documentary photography work, more photojournalism, and continue to explore and have some of these experiences that that are not available to a lot of people. And so being able to in some way bring some of those experiences to people, bring that knowledge to kind of a wider audience, I think is really valuable. And it's a very rewarding work, very interesting work, and usually like a great amount of interest in it, as I say, because if people aren't able to get there themselves, they do like the photographic aspect as much as anything else.
David, thank you very much indeed for the storytelling aspects of the Balkans as far as it's had an impact on you. I don't think, as I say, that we're ever over learning, which is quite sad today, because the human race is still carving itself up, except this time in Central Europe. So hopefully that will dissipate. David, thank you very much for being with us this morning from the hill overlooking Kitchener and Waterloo. And I hope it won't be too long before you're back here, because we do exceedingly nice rakia.
You sure do. And I have to say, I can't wait to get back because of I got to see a lot of things on those previous trips. But one of the things, every time you go to the Balkans, you see is, how much more there is to learn and to experience. And, I think about, from the music festival I didn't get to go to starting to learn about other parts of Montenegro and Albania and places that I haven't been able to get to yet. There's so many interesting areas around there. And it's so close. It's so easy to travel around by bus or by train or however you're moving. And so one of the great things of traveling around the region that you have adopted as your home. So it's a great place. Can't wait to come back and see everyone again.
David Harms, Professor in Media at the University of Waterloo in Canada. Well, thanks so much for listening. If you would like to support this podcast, then please consider leaving a review or maybe buy us a coffee. The link is in the show notes. Oh, and why not share this podcast with friends or anyone who you think might be interested? Until next time then, from Tamara and me, please do stay safe wherever you are. And that's a wrap for this podcast. We hope you've enjoyed finding out a little more about both Bosnia and Herzegovina and the wider Western Balkans.
If you've enjoyed this journey as much as we enjoy bringing it to you, please take a moment to leave us a review and subscribe to our podcast. Your feedback helps us tremendously and makes a huge difference. Thank you once again for joining us, and we'll see you on the next episode.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you would like to support us and the production of future episodes, then please consider maybe giving us a tip or becoming a member of our podcast family. The link to do that is in the show notes for this podcast. Thanks again for listening. We really do appreciate it.
You're listening to An Englishman in the Balkans.
Welcome to An Englishman in the Balkans podcast with me, David Pacinovich Bailey. In this podcast, you'll get a unique look at life in Bosnia and Herzegovina through my eyes, the eyes of an immigrant. Each episode, I share my experiences living in this often misunderstood country and introduce you to some of the interesting people I've met along the way. From exploring the rich culture and history to discussing the challenges and joys of immigrating to a new country, this podcast offers a thoughtful and engaging look at life in the Western Balkans. So that's it for this one. Thanks for keeping me company. If you enjoyed the episode, maybe share it with a friend who might like it too. And if you've got thoughts, questions, or just want to say hello, you can always reach out. Also, if you'd like to support the podcast and help me keep telling these stories, you can drop a little tip via Buy Me a Coffee. The link is in the show notes. Even a euro or two makes a big difference. So that's it then. Take care, and I'll catch you in the next episode.